You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Most of you have heard me preach from the Gospel of Thomas before. Thomas is that fascinating little collection of Jesus sayings discovered in the Egyptian desert in 1945. It never made the final cut into the New Testament alongside Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but over the last several decades, it has earned enormous respect among scholars. In fact, many people believe that Thomas may preserve some of Jesus' earliest teachings, perhaps even predating our canonical Gospels by multiple decades. The saying we're going to hear this morning also appears in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but if you compare them with Thomas, something interesting happens. The later Gospel writers spin the story into a Christianity versus Judaism promo. Robert Funk of the Jesus Seminar points out that the authors of the Synoptic Gospels equate this new Jesus movement with new wine, and the old wineskins become Judaism itself, essentially setting up an adversarial relationship. They also emphasize the foolishness of taking an old patch and putting it on a new garment, because everyone knows the new fabric will pull away from the old and create a tear. None of that is part of Thomas's agenda. Instead, pay special attention to how often everything in this little saying is either alive, changing, stretching, fermenting, or becoming something it wasn't before. Herein lies the good stuff that Thomas is advocating for.
Our words of wisdom are from the Gospel of Thomas, 47b.
Jesus said, "No one drinks old wine and immediately desires to drink new wine."
And new wine is not put into old wineskins, lest they burst, nor is old wine put into new wineskins, lest it spoil it.
An old patch is not sewn onto a new garment, because a tear would result.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Sixteen years ago, this very weekend, I had the honor of officiating at my friends Mark and Dave's wedding at a winery in Paso Robles, California. Since then, Mark earned a degree in enology at the UC Davis Department of Viticulture and Enology, and is now a professional enologist at a winery in Napa Valley. An enologist, you say? Yeah. They're the chemists behind the alchemy that turns grapes into wine. And every time we get together, I get way more from Mark than learning how to say things like, I'm getting hints of blackberry. I get a deep dive into the art and science of making wine. So when I was reading today's passage in Thomas, I had questions. So I called Mark. I wanted to know what Jesus was hiding inside this seemingly innocuous little saying that modern wine drinkers might be missing. And as it turns out, we're missing quite a bit. Right off the bat, Jesus begins, "No one drinks old wine and immediately desires to drink new wine." Now, I'd always heard that as a statement acknowledging the refined taste of a connoisseur. Old wine has a more complex taste profile than new wine. It's more sophisticated. But no, Mark explained that after you've tasted several really good aged wines, the chemistry of your palate becomes saturated. Those rich tannins that give an old Cabernet its depth also bind to your saliva and create what winemakers call palate fatigue. After four or five sips, your tongue simply can't detect subtle flavors anymore. That's why professional wine tastings always begin with the newest, lightest wines and gradually move toward the older, heavier, more complex wines. You don't start with the boldest vintage because once you do, you start to lose the ability to appreciate everything that follows. It isn't that the new wine is inferior, its taste profile is just more subtle, and your taste buds become incapable of perceiving the difference. Suddenly, Jesus' observation sounds less like a wine snob dissing anything but old wine, and more like the practical observation that any connoisseur knows. The new stuff isn't worse, it's subtle. And once your palate has been overpowered by the complexity of the old, it's hard to pick up on what the new has to offer. But if that's all Jesus meant, Thomas wouldn't have kept talking. So then comes the line most of us know. You don't put new wine into old wineskins. Again, I always assumed Jesus was simply saying old things are bad and new things are good. Not even close. And unfortunately, that's also the reading that was eventually adopted by Christians to contrast themselves over against Judaism. But Thomas wasn't into that kind of one-upmanship. Thomas's Jesus understood what new wine actually was. And new wine is an altogether different beverage. New wine is wine that is actively fermenting. And because the yeast is actively at work, the ABV, the alcohol by volume, actively fluctuates between 9%, 12%, or more. Today, new wine is very popular in Germany. After the grape harvest in the fall, Germans can stop at roadside stands to drink Federweisser. But Americans have been denied this treat for over 100 years. Why? Because Prohibition-era laws are still on the books that make it impossible to sell new wine. For alcohol to be sold in the U.S., a federal tax has to be paid based on how much alcohol is in the drink. Since the ABV of new wine is constantly changing by the hour, there's no way to determine the new tax. Add to that the fact you can't put a stopper on it, lest it explode, and it becomes impractical to sell it in the U.S. But since there was no prohibition in Germany and no zombie ABV tax codes, new wine is available freely, but you have to bring your own bottle. So, Jesus said new wine is not put into old wineskins because, of course, new wine is actively fermenting and would burst an old, rigid wineskin. Today, most of us reading this passage dismiss new wine as something that's only been aging for a few months and just not as good. But like today's Germans, ancient people appreciated it because new wine is literally alive. It's still fermenting. The yeast, tiny single-celled living microorganisms, are busy consuming the fruit's sugar, producing alcohol, and pooping out carbon dioxide. And here's the kicker. That layer of carbon dioxide seals the wine off from any microbes or bacteria getting in that could ruin the wine. Think about the beauty of this metaphor for the spiritual life. New wine isn't finished. It's still becoming what it could one day become. And because of all the foment, you can't cork it, You can't bottle it. You certainly wouldn't want to pour it into an old, brittle wineskin that had already stretched as far as it could stretch. The problem isn't the quality of the new wine. It's the inability of the container to stretch and accommodate the life bubbling inside of it. That'll preach. How often is that condition true of us? An inability to stretch and accommodate new life. I've been reading Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs this summer and was fascinated to learn that the most iconic, revolutionary innovations Jobs fostered at Apple were the direct result of someone telling him that something couldn't be done. Boom! He would then become manic in his obsession with pushing his teams to do what no one had ever done before. Stretch, foment, bubbling up with transformation. Meanwhile, what does the church do? It clings to the 11th commandment. We've never done it that way before. Stick to the old way of thinking, the old way of doing, the old way of being. And Thomas isn't done. Mark, Matthew, and Luke all stop with the old not accommodating the new and bursting wineskins. They all left out Thomas's last sentence. Nor is old wine put into a new wineskin, lest it spoil. What? Here's the deal. Remember that while wine is actively fermenting, the carbon dioxide burped out by the yeast actually forms a protective blanket over the surface of the wine. That shield keeps harmful bacteria out. While the wine is alive, it's actually protecting itself. But once fermentation ends, the protection disappears and the wine becomes vulnerable. That's why wineries obsess over cleanliness before bottling. Every hose, every tank, every valve is sterilized because the tiniest contamination can quietly turn an amazing wine into vinegar. You don't put old wine into a new wineskin because old wine has stopped fermenting. No yeast at work. No carbon dioxide, no protective barrier to fend off contaminants. Some of you remember the couple of times Thomas scholar Stephen Patterson has spoken at the fountains. He has observed that overall, Thomas is less interested in getting people to believe differently than in helping them see differently. For Thomas's Jesus, the kingdom of God isn't something arriving someday that we believe in. It's already here. And we, like the yeast, mustard seed, and other contaminants in Jesus' parables, are called to be actively fomenting change. But alas, many Jesus followers are rigidly functioning with old assumptions, old habits, old fears, and old expectations, all poured into a new container. Let's call the container the 21st century, and it's all quietly turning to vinegar. So in this seemingly harmless little aphorism lurks two of the greatest challenges for Jesus followers today. The first one is not evil, not heresy, not atheism, it's rigidity. If you get stuck believing that because something once brought you life, it's got to always look exactly the same, you stop stretching, you stop being curious, and rigidity is sneaky. It knows not to announce itself as rigidity. It disguises itself as tradition. Once upon a time, a renowned Buddhist teacher had a cat who had the habit of wandering into the room every evening and distracting everyone trying to meditate. So the teacher agreed to have the cat tied outside the room during meditation. Years later, the teacher died, but out of habit, the cat kept getting tied up. Eventually, the cat died, so the temple got another cat. Centuries later, scholars were writing elaborate theological treatises on the sacred significance of tying up a cat before meditating. Now, if you're tempted to laugh, think about your family, political parties, denominations, your own life. How many cats are you still tying up? How many things are you simply doing because somebody once had a reason we no longer remember? And that slides right into the second challenge we have: mindlessly babbling the same old creeds, ideas, and rituals, but dressing them up in superficial new containers. You've seen them: laser light shows, flying Christmas drummers, and performative demands to get prayer back in our schools, and posting the Ten Commandments in classrooms. Meanwhile, Jesus' radical and demanding vision of the kingdom turning the world upside down is slowly turning to vinegar. Friends, at its best, the Methodist movement has always been about foment, agitation, and stretching the boundaries. John Wesley didn't want adherents to simply believe stuff because someone handed them the answers, but because the movement gave them the permission to wrestle with the realities of life. Wesley wanted Methodists to know why they believed what they believed. And that only comes from questioning, exploring new paths, and stretching with new information. Along with Jesus, the mystics, and the prophets of old, Wesley knew that a genuinely living faith has never been about preserving certainty. It's been about growing, changing, and living into the demands of the here and now. Howard Thurman said it most memorably: "Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive." And being alive, that fermentation, is really just another word for transformation. The grape doesn't become a better grape. It stops being a grape altogether. After the yeast does its job gobbling up the sugar, releasing alcohol and carbon dioxide, it dies. And what remains is something entirely new. It's not cosmetic. It's chemical, foundational, irreversible. That's not loss. That's resurrection. That's life well lived. Maybe that's why Thomas fills this saying with things that stretch and shrink and ferment and change. Nothing is static. Everything is becoming. In the end, the tragedy isn't that yesterday was wrong. Yesterday may have been what yesterday needed. The tragedy is trying to force yesterday into containing tomorrow. I can't believe all the spiritual energy that gets squandered forever asking whether we should. Should I question this? Should I rethink that? Should we try something different? Should we welcome these people? Should we let go of this tradition? Should. Meanwhile, life keeps percolating. The wine keeps fermenting. Creation keeps creating. And all the while, we completely miss what we could become. We spend so much time worrying about whether we should change that we never discover what we could become if we did change. And that idea isn't unique to Jesus. It's a truth about the human condition that comes in many guises. I recently finished reading Octavia Butler's science fiction classics, The Parable of the Sower and The Parable of the Talents. In them, the protagonist, a young Black woman trying to survive in post-apocalyptic America, is sowing the seeds of a new religion she calls Earthseed, the intriguing core of which is the idea that God is change, change itself. You can learn to roll with change, learn from change, and grow, or you can fight against it and be crushed. One of her Earthseed aphorisms is perfect for today's stream of thought. All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. That's fermentation. That's following Jesus. That's putting love first. You cannot genuinely love another person without being changed by them. You cannot honestly seek truth without discovering new truths that rearrange you. And you most certainly cannot follow the authentic Jesus very far without eventually becoming someone your younger self would hardly recognize. Maybe that's what Thomas's Jesus was trying to tell us all along. The kingdom isn't a museum where yesterday is carefully preserved behind velvet ropes. Don't put that old patch on the new thing that is bubbling up. You're only going to compromise what the Spirit is up to. If the spiritual life is anything like making wine, everything is active. Everything is changing. Everything is becoming something it wasn't before. You, me, our institutions. It's the opposite of rigid. It's about embracing the unpredictable, living process of transformation. The holiness Jesus embodied was never about rigidity. It was about a process. A holiness supple enough to allow new things to ferment that not even he could imagine. And that's why the question Jesus leaves us with isn't, should I change? But imagine what could be if I do. Be well.
Don't forget, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a coffee. The link's in the description.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.